This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Perimenopause has been all over social media for the last several months. But along with menopause and postmenopause, it affects millions of people's lives across the country and joins a long list of understudied areas of women's health.
Morning sickness, endometriosis, menopause, migraines, PCOS. What's happening to your body? We don't know because we've never really studied the female body.
Dr. Makeba Williams is an obstetrician, gynecologist, and certified menopause practitioner who's doing her part to try to change what we know and understand about menopause specifically. And she joins us now. Dr. Williams, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Were you rocking out to that?
I did find myself moving to the beats.
So, Dr. Williams, to set the stage, give us a quick rundown. What is perimenopause?
Perimenopause is that transition from our reproductive period where our ovaries are functioning on a cyclical basis, spitting out hormones, to what we would say is this area where our bodies begin to change in many different organ systems because the ovaries are no longer reliably secreting estrogen and progestogen. And this happens as the ovaries age. It manifests in changes to the menstrual cycles. They become less predictable. Women may begin to experience what we call vasomotor symptoms, or commonly known as hot flashes and night sweats. As the estrogen level continues to decline and nadirs, we will see impacts to our cardiovascular system, our bones, and many other areas of our body.
I mean, since it affects so much, why is it that we have not heard much about perimenopause in the past?
Largely, what we have focused on from a research standpoint has been menopause, when that point in time where there is no longer estrogen output. And that is unfortunate. But it also represents an opportunity for us to better study and understand this transition period. So there is a gap in our knowledge, it's a gap in our clinical delivery, and thankfully, as there has been democratization of information, there is more inquiry into this important transition phase of life.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the common misperceptions about menopause, perimenopause, and postmenopause?
I think the biggest misconception that I hear is that menopause is an event that will happen on one day. We do know that the average age of menopause is 51, 52. Every person born with ovaries will experience the event, but how it is experienced is unique. And so the misconception is it's a one and done, when in fact the menopause transition can occur over a long period of years. It can be as much as 7 years. So it is a transition period. I will often analogize it to the puberty transition, where there is a sequence of events, a sequence of changes that are happening. And that is true of the menopause transition, also known as perimenopause.
Mm-hmm. When you make that puberty comparison, does that turn a light on for some people? Does it make it easier for them to understand?
I do believe so. There, we know that menopause and perimenopause has been shrouded in silence, both from a clinical standpoint, from a research standpoint, and culturally, in that there have not been enough conversations in communities about this, a lack of conversations in clinical spaces. And we treat puberty so differently. I think about it as when you take a child to a pediatrician as they are getting into their 10, 11 years old, the pediatrician begins to do what we call anticipatory guidance. They foreshadow some of the changes that will occur, and those changes are normalized. Contrast that what has happened for too long with perimenopause and menopause. That anticipatory guidance has not been delivered. And so when we can use these analogies, the light bulb often goes off for those experiencing the transition, and it speaks to them and says, I want to know more. I should know more about this transition, which I am experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Williams, the last time we spoke, we discussed the way conversations about menopause and perimenopause show up in pop culture and in social media. And of course, you know, what each of us sees on social media is built by an algorithm. But the democratization that you talked about earlier, I mean, is there something more to the surge in attention to these particular parts of women's health than the social media surge?
I do believe that there is greater awareness and attunement and interest in what is going on with our bodies, with our health. And now we have more access. I will often find that many of my patients who come in are dealing with some of the symptoms of perimenopause. And one of those that can be very distressing is sleep disruption. And so when that sleep disruption occurs at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, it is often met with a lot of scrolling. And what do we often have on our bedside tables, or dare I say, under our pillows, is a handheld computer. Mm. And with that, you can, when you have these moments of wakefulness, you can turn on that device and seek information. You can type into chatbots or into search engines your symptoms. And then, as you say, there are these algorithms that will continue to feed you information. So I think it is the intersection of being curious about what's going on with your body and also having a device and other platforms that will answer the questions, your curiosity, feed your curiosity.
So as a leading expert in menopause research, Dr. Williams, is there a way to responsibly consume the content that you've described? And are there some ways in which it is actually detrimental?
I am happy and pleased that we are living in an information age where information is readily available, where we are able to dispel some silencing and myths and cultural tolerance for what has been happening for far too long and the negativity around menopause. So it's great that we are in this information age, but information that is being delivered without individualization, without scientific background and evidence can be dangerous. So it is great that we have access to the information, and it is my belief that we need to partner with healthcare providers who can individualize and explain the nuances of the information that individuals are taking in. So there has to be a partnership between this democratized information and what we know is clinically relevant, useful, and evidentially sound.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of taking note, but not self-diagnosing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We want to stay away from those you name the search engine, right? And check that with your healthcare provider. What we do see, and the last time I was on, we talked about these gaps and disparities in care. And we know that some of those disparities in care stem from a lack of a relationship, a lack of trust with healthcare providers, and we see a differential use of and reliance upon social media and other information sources depending on different demographics. So it is important that we are building these trusting relationships with healthcare providers so that women, those experiencing menopause, have a safe, trusted space to ask the questions, to have conversations, rather than relying upon social media and search engines alone.
Mm-hmm. The disparities that you had talked with us about the last time you were on run largely along the lines of race and ethnicity, and then socioeconomic factors also play into this. Has there been any, you know, observed improvement in that since the last time we spoke?
Certainly. My previous research documented the gaps, and that focused on the gaps as we saw them related to race, where I have shown that African American women will experience a longer duration of hot flashes and night sweats. They experience them for far more severely. They're half as likely to be treated. And so our work now focuses on why those gaps persist and investigating interventions and designing solutions to close the gap. What we are also recognizing is the gaps are furthered by, you know, these what we call social determinants of health. And, you know, they fall into the pillars of our structural and physical environment, where we live, where we work, where we play, our access, our healthcare systems access. How are we able to access evidence-based menopause care and knowledge? Do we have access to treatment? And of course, there is biology. It's our behavior, how we tune into our health. And it's becoming quite apparent that it's not just about race. There are other socio-demographic factors that play here. And one of those that we are investigating is location of residence, where we see individuals in rural communities experience menopause differentially, where there is a difference in the symptoms that they experience, how they access healthcare information, and whether or not they are using therapies. So our research continues to uncover opportunities to close additional gaps that were far under-recognized.
Mm-hmm. How did that come to light? That difference based on what kind of environment people are living in, that the rural part of it is really, it's fascinating.
It is truly fascinating. My colleague, Dr. Pauline Mackey, recently published this data that shows that women who are rural residing, when we compare them to women who live in urban and suburban locations, that they are experiencing a significantly higher rate of muscle and joint pain. They experience more panic attacks, and they have the highest rates of being uninsured, and again, less likely to be taking hormone therapy as treatment. And they, in these rural communities, are relying more on their healthcare providers to provide information. They are less likely to use social media. So this was an exploration to better understand how residentiality impacts menopause experiences. And here we are now challenged with this information to better tailor interventions, to be culturally responsive, not simply based upon race and ethnicity, but taking into account geographic residence to tailor solutions and interventions to close those gaps. So it stems from a point of curiosity to drill down on what are those factors, what are those environmental factors, what are those built structural determinants that influence the ways in which women are experiencing menopause and accessing care.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Williams, have you been following social media and certain people in particular and the way that they have been delivering information about perimenopause and menopause? I'm thinking about the We Do Not Care Club. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But humor seems to be one way that folks are getting more information out there?
It is quite interesting how information is being delivered, and what we know is it is important, you know, to have demographic representation and demographic compatibility. For far too long, we have seen that there are some central themes that come to play on how women experience menopause, how they communicate menopause, and we see in many minoritized communities that there is a lot of tolerance, minimization, and silencing. And so to the extent that there are newer voices coming on the scene that can speak with humor, with humility, with demographic compatibility, it does give us opportunity to open the conversation, to remove some of the taboo that has historically shrouded menopause conversations. And hopefully that provides an opportunity, it provides license for individuals experiencing these symptoms to seek care that is relevant to their experience.
Mm-hmm. Is there a piece of advice that you have for women who are seeking a practitioner who can talk with them about these things, especially if they've had the experience of not being listened to about their experiences with perimenopause and menopause?
You raise an important question and point in that there are many who have breached that sort of fear and have presented to healthcare providers. And many I've heard say that they have been medically gaslit, they have been dismissed. And we want to empower those individuals to have an act to be able to access the resources, empathetic, kind care that they need that is so critically important. At the Menopause Society, which is the leading organization, leading voice in the menopause conversation, we have a search provider search engine where one can type in their zip code and find a certified menopause provider who is equipped with the knowledge and the skill to be able to deliver that empathetic care. I think that is a first step in making sure that you are aligning and connecting with an individual who is specifically trained and certified to be able to deliver that care. And that is an essential part of the work that I do, is training the next generation of providers so that when individuals are coming in with their symptoms, those that were rattled off in that catchy music, that they don't meet a provider that will gaslight them, that is not knowledgeable. So that is essential work that we are building a pipeline of clinicians who can meet this growing demand.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Makeba Williams is a St. Louis resident and an obstetrician, gynecologist, and certified menopause practitioner. Dr. Williams, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfley.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.